Welcome to The Checkup, brought to you by Medcast, your go-to source for practical insights, clinical updates, and real conversations that matter to healthcare professionals. Whether you're on the go or taking a break, we're here to keep you informed, connected, and inspired.
Hi, and thank you for joining us. My name is Dr. Rebecca Chan. I'm a GP and medical educator with Medcast, and I'll be your host for this podcast series exploring recent clinical updates in women's health. I'm recording today from the land of the Wangal people of the Eora Nation. On today's podcast, we'll be looking at recent changes to the Australian Diabetes in Pregnancy Society guidelines for gestational diabetes, what's changed, why these changes were made, and what they mean for GPs in everyday practice. Our guest on the podcast today is Associate Professor Glynis Ross. She's been the lead endocrinologist of the Diabetes and Pregnancy Service at RPA for over 30 years, and she's held leadership roles across Diabetes Australia, the Australian Diabetes Society, and the Australasian Diabetes in Pregnancy Society. She continues to play a key role in shaping national diabetes care through her involvement in expert advisory groups and teaching programs. Glynis is joining us today from the lands of the Gadigal people. Welcome, Glynis.
Hello, Rebecca.
So can you start off with telling us what's changed in the most recent ADIPS consensus recommendations and why those changes were implemented?
Okay. So it might be better if I just go back over some of the background history on the diagnosis of gestational diabetes to set the scene. So going back to prior to 1990, so a very long time ago, there was a survey across Australia and there were a large number of different versions of testing for gestational diabetes. Usually it was confined to women with high levels of risk factors. And that was a similar issue internationally as well. So it made it very difficult for both clinicians and for women with, who were being diagnosed with gestational diabetes to really work out why they may have it in one area and if they went to another city or another hospital that they may or may not have it. And also it was recognised that women were being missed. So there was a series of meetings in the late 1980s orchestrated by what became the Australasian Diabetes and Pregnancy Society to try and come up with Australian consensus guidelines. And that was what led to a publication in the MJA, it was either 1990 or 1991, with the initial consensus targets using a glucose challenge test to screen for women who were more likely to get gestational diabetes and then following it with a full 75-gram GTT. And at that time, only a fasting glucose and 2-hour were agreed upon at the consensus meeting. A 1-hour wasn't agreed upon, ran out of time, and it didn't reconvene. And that was, so that's just always a bit of an absence from that guideline. But this screening was all confined to usually around the 28-week mark, unless individual clinicians felt there was a need to assess glucose tolerance earlier in the pregnancy. What happened after that was that there was a very large HARPO study. So that was the Hyperglycemia and Pregnancy Outcomes Study, and this involved about 25,500 women worldwide, broad range of countries and ethnicities. And it was an observational study, not an intervention study. So in this, if the women were participating in this study, they underwent a 75-gram oral glucose tolerance test aiming for 28 weeks, but being such a large study, they did accept any GTTs between 24 and 32 weeks. The results of the studies were only revealed if the women met pre-defined criteria for clear-cut diabetes where there was no argument that that needed identifying and treating. The results for all of the other women were blinded, and so these were not treated, and it was just then following the pregnancy, looking at what the primary outcomes were. So they included things like, you know, large for gestational age, need for primary cesarean delivery, neonatal hypoglycemia, and also for cord C-peptide levels, which is a surrogate for how much insulin the baby's needing to make in response to the mum's glucose. And then looking at the glucose levels and the GTT at the fasting level, 1 hour and 2 hour, to see how they correlated with the primary outcomes. Mm-hmm. And the hope was that there might be an inflection point at which a line in the sand would be put to say, well, this above this level, women should be diagnosed with gestational diabetes, below that not. But unfortunately, that wasn't what happened, and it was a fairly continuous relationship for all the primary outcomes. There was then a series of meetings held in the US, and again, very large meetings with broad representation from countries with clinicians with interest in the area, thrashing out how to go about working out diagnosis. So they were at the time proposed using 1.5 odds ratio of an adverse outcome, 1.75 and 2.0. The 1.5 odds ratio got knocked off pretty quickly, and it was reasonably close between the 1.75 and the 2.0 odds ratio as to which one to use for determining the criteria for gestational diabetes moving forward. At the time, the decision was made generally to use the 1.75 odds ratio, which led to the criteria we were using with the 2014 ADIPS recommendations. And so those levels were 5.1, 10, and 8.5. Now, some countries, so Canada, for example, started initially saying you could use the 1.75 odds ratio or a 2.0 odds ratio. They moved soon to a 2.0 odds ratio thereafter. And so there has been variation internationally as to what's been done. This was all around the time of routine testing at around that 28-week time frame. In reality, there was also the caveat that if women did have high risk factors, to consider early testing, but it wasn't done on a systematic basis. The next major study that has now informed the new guidelines was the Toboggan study. So that was predominantly an Australian study, and it was spearheaded by David Simmons and a number of Australian sites, but also a couple of overseas sites were involved. Women who went into this study basically had identified risk factors for gestational diabetes, and they underwent early glucose tolerance testing. And there was a complex randomizing as to what happened there. And if anyone wants to know more detail, they really need to read the study design. It is a very complex thing to try and describe on this. But ultimately, the majority of women also underwent a glucose tolerance test at around 28 weeks. So some women who were identified early were managed, mm-hmm. and they didn't go through a 28-week one, but others were blinded. They may have had abnormal results early, but were blinded in the way it was done, that then underwent another GTT at around 28 weeks. So then all of the data have been analysed, and basically it showed that identifying women earlier in pregnancy and starting management early did lead to some increase in benefit on pregnancy outcomes. It also was only apparent in the early GTTs if the 2.0 odds ratio was used. So if women met the 1.75 odds ratio criteria but weren't meeting the 2.0 odds ratio, which was a little bit higher, so those levels were 5.3, 10.6 and 9, so that in-between group, you couldn't demonstrate benefit of treatment when they were diagnosed early. So that's what's led to the advice that, well, the best benefit was to identify women early and then to start treatment at that point. But as I said, demonstrating benefit from the higher odds ratio use. So the recommendation in the new guidelines is for women with no risk factors for gestational diabetes, and they're all spelled out quite clearly what the risk factors were that were used in the Toboggan study and are used in the new ADIPS guideline. Women with no risk factors, the recommendation is that they should be tested at 28 weeks.
Yep.
If there are risk factors, the recommendation is for an early assessment. Ideally, this would be through GP at the time of the early antenatal bloods. So ideally before 10 weeks, so ideally around 6 weeks. And that's predominantly with an HbA1c, and some site will use a fasting glucose where possible as well. That isn't necessarily going to be done at all sites.
Yep.
if they're over certain criteria, that'll mostly be if they're meeting the very high criteria for overt diabetes. But otherwise, the women should be encouraged to have an early GTT between 10 and 14 weeks. And if that test is normal, then should be retested at around that routine 28-week time.
So it sounds like it's sort of been, I guess, a natural progression of where the research has gone over the years. And I guess, yeah, the biggest changes is we've now, at least for the standard 28 weeks, moved to that 2.0 odds ratio criteria. So that is the fasting at 5.3, the 1 hour at 10.6, and the 2 hour at 9, rather than the 1.7 odds ratio. And it's really interesting to hear, I guess, how we get to those numbers based off those odd ratios as well. And then, yes, as you said, it sounds like there's more clarification around the suggested approach to that early pregnancy screening as well. Are we expecting that most labs and hospitals will be using these updated guidelines for diagnosis, or is there still some variation in that?
Look, there will be some variation. So I can't speak for all states at the moment, but Victoria and Queensland changed.
Yep.
They've changed quite quickly. In New South Wales, New South Wales health pathology changed on the 8th of September.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly at least one of the large private labs, Douglas Hanly Moir, changed on the 15th. And what will happen with the other private labs, I'm assuming they will go. Now, then there are going to be some potentially local criteria that may modify local reporting as well. There are potentially still going to be some differences, but it's reasonably aligned within New South Wales with some minor variations.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the most important message is probably make sure you're aware of what your local health service
Absolutely.
Is doing.
So I think it's, and I don't think people should be worrying about these very minor variations. These are not ones that are going to cause huge clinical significance.
And I guess local service providers, I think even with the previous criteria, I found like blood sugar level targets tended to be specific to different services. And again, I imagine that would probably still be similar.
Yeah, so management decisions, again, will have a little bit of variation. And certainly ADIPS is in process of updating a management guideline for gestational diabetes. But again, there will probably be slight variations in local services as well. But again, I would expect most will be very close to the standard approach.
Yep. And again, this may be something that you need to speak to more from your local service because it may change in different areas. But I guess thinking about women who are currently under care, and I guess we've got this short interim period where we will have women who were only recently diagnosed under the old guidelines, are we still calling them gestational diabetes going forward now?
Absolutely. That's been one of the things I've been very emphatic about in communicating to our care providers. I think the worst thing is to be giving conflicting messages to women.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is it doesn't matter where you put the lines in the sand. If you're over a certain level, you're at high risk than someone was below that level.
Yep.
And this has also got implication for future risk of diabetes discussions as well.
Yep.
So I have strongly said that any women who are either currently under our care, stay under our care, and I want zero mention of any change to guidelines or diagnostic criteria.
Yep.
Were they the ones that, you know, there's only going to be a certain number that will be in that band anyway.
Yes, yeah.
That may have been undiagnosed. If women are still referred in to the service, so whether it's from a GP or whether they've been told by a midwife or an obstetrician that they've got gestational diabetes and the old criteria were used, they weren't being diagnosed on the new criteria, they should be absolutely continued with the same discussion and just provided into management. No discussion about, oh, well, actually, no, you no longer meet the criteria, you don't have it. That is a really bad message to give to women, potentially is critical of the person who's referred them as well. And I think that is really poor. When we're looking at women who have been diagnosed under previous criteria down the track, it's not saying, oh, well, you no longer have future risk of diabetes. That's not true.
Yep.
So if they've been diagnosed on any criteria, they do remain at high risk of future diabetes, high risk of future cardiovascular disease, and they should be followed up accordingly and not just suddenly say, oh, no, you don't need it because you wouldn't be diagnosed now.
Yep. So I guess the answer then to my next question is probably similar, but those who were diagnosed, say, 3 or 4 years ago and, you know, have been advised to have that 5-yearly glucose tolerance test, we still continue with that.
And even on the old criteria, like even before the 2014 criteria or whatever, it's exactly the same. So we could say, oh, look, they're not really at risk. That's actually not true. They remain at increased risk of future diabetes and cardiovascular disease and therefore should be continued to follow up. So any history of gestational diabetes.
Yep. And I guess going forward, once we get more into these new criteria as, you know, the standard guidelines, you know, for women who do sit just below those levels or they're sort of, you know, not they're under, but they don't quite meet the criteria, would you recommend any interventions or management? Like, would you recommend the GP still discuss?
So I think it's exceedingly difficult to give a clean answer that applies to everyone.
Yeah.
I think my general take is that in the ideal world, all women who would like to have a pregnancy should ideally plan in the best possible circumstances on the home front, financial front, as well as medical front. So as part of that discussion, clearly, particularly these days with the increasing rates of overweight and obesity within the whole country, including in women of childbearing age, you know, assessment of optimal weights should be undertaken, general discussion about optimal nutrition in outside pregnancy, but giving also some guidelines of, well, you know, for you, it would be appropriate once you're pregnant that this would be your weight gain. Mm-hmm. And it will be important to keep on a balanced diet, covering all the nutritional bases, et cetera. And then giving that added support to all women once they're pregnant, because encouraging the diet, encouraging good exercise and appropriate weight gain remain important whether or not there's any involvement with gestational diabetes. So that's just standard pregnancy guidance.
Yeah.
So, and clearly the GP has the massive role in providing this information. That's their role.
Yeah.
A big role for them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that really highlights the importance of, you know, just taking that individualized approach. And it's also a good reminder that, you know, lifestyle advice is always going to be beneficial for everyone, regardless of where they may sit on, you know, against any thresholds or anything like that. And just keeping that risk in mind and making sure that we're monitoring them long term as well.
Yeah. And it's the frequency of monitoring and what you're going to do that may change depending on their level of risk. So if, you know, if they've got multiple high level risk factors, particularly if they're very high risk ethnicity, and we particularly see this in our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander populations, Pacific Islander, and also the South Asian cohort, so mm-hmm. Indian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan, Nepalese, Mongolian, everyone else I've forgotten, Tibetan, we know that they're at much higher risk of future diabetes earlier a pregnancy complicated by gestational diabetes, whereas mostly for the other ethnicities, there's a little bit more of a lag time unless they're already very close. But I think it's just, you know, regular health checks, given how common diabetes in general terms is becoming, is a good thing anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And then I guess finally, just to finish up today, not quite related to these recent changes or anything, but I wanted to ask a practical question which GPs do often face, which is managing those patients who just can't tolerate a glucose tolerance test. You know, they've tried it before, they've thrown up, they just say, I'm not doing it. What's your recommendation? So this is for someone without risk factors at that, you know, sort of 26, 28 weeks.
Yeah. Okay. So just as some extra pointers on performing a GTT as well. So the tolerance tends to be best if the women are given the drink very cold.
Yep.
That tends to be tolerated better. If there's the option of a recliner chair, that also helps women. So that those two maneuvers themselves can reduce the trend to vomiting. If we've had a problem, I mean, we would generally try it again using those circumstances, and also we can give Maxilon ahead of the test, but we shouldn't give ondansetron. So ondansetron impacts on the stomach emptying, but it actually improves glucose tolerance.
That's it. That's interesting.
Yeah. So metoclopramide doesn't tend to have an impact.
Okay.
So that's another manoeuvre. But If the women decline, and clearly some of the women will have even tried it under those circumstances and still may not tolerate, unfortunately, or they may just really not be able to, they've had such a bad experience that they clearly don't want to go through it. There is no easy alternative, is the bottom line. So you can measure an HbA1c, but remember, it's only giving you an average over the last couple of months. An upper limit of normal in pregnancy is viewed as 5.5%, but a lot of our women diagnosed with gestational diabetes will have an actual HbA1c around the time of diagnosis that is far lower than that. So it's not at all a sensitive test, but it should pick up a bigger concern issue. The women can purchase a glucose meter, preferably one of the more reliable ones, because there is variation on accuracy, unfortunately, which makes life a bit more complicated. But they will not have subsidized testing strips. So this will be private purchase of a meter and related strips. So they could be then asked for a two-week period to do finger prick checks pre-breakfast, and depending on what your local policies are, whether you do 1 hour or 2 hours post-meal. Our service for decades has used 1 hour as the trying to get the peak glucose. Yeah. I know many around Australia just use 2 hour, but they would also need to record their dietary intake at that time, because yeah. one of the concerns if they're worrying about their glucose levels is that they could suddenly just pull back and not have any carbohydrates, which A, is bad for pregnancy in any case, but also it means that you're not really assessing their tolerance of yep. meals. So they really need to be having adequate carbohydrates. So ideally recording their glucose levels and getting a feel for what that is. But there, yeah, again, it's not in an ideal setting, but it may pick up significant deterioration. The third thing that they could consider, but again, it's got large limitations, is purchasing the CGM sensor. So this would usually be either the Libre 2 sensor at present or the Dexcom One Plus sensor. And you get 15 days or 10 and a half days of data. Now, again, they're not particularly sensitive, but it will give an overview of what the glucose levels are, but again, having to look at it compared to what their recorded diet is at that period of time. So ideally given some suggestions as to what their dietary pattern should be would be better, but equally may just want to see what's happening on their usual diet first. So again, limitations, they're not so accurate. And you know, there are no consensus guidelines as to what CGM data should be like in gestational diabetes. Mm-hmm. They're only agreed upon in type 1, which is a way more complex setting. But I would expect in a gestational diabetes woman that generally the mean glucose should probably be under about, definitely should be under 6, probably 5.5. And the time in the tight pregnancy range, which is not the standard CGM range, the tight pregnancy range is 3.5 to 7.8, and they should be probably 95% time in range. The other setting where it's this is actually required, these alternate things, is in the increasing number of women who have undergone bariatric surgery. So a lot of those women, if you give them a glucose tolerance test, will get dumping syndrome, which is awful for them to go through.
Yeah.
So if they've had previous bariatric surgery, the general advice is they should not have a GTT, but they okay. should have the alternate testings undertaken yep. periodically through the pregnancy. If they're known to have diabetes, then they should get managed anyway.
Yep.
But yes, it is a really important issue for the women with bariatric surgery.
Yeah, that's a good one to be aware of as well. And it, so it sounds like the glucose tolerance test is the gold standard. If we can optimize it, that's the best way to go about it.
It's limitations, and yep. it has got significant limitations. It remains the preferred test in this setting. Could I just make one comment going back? I just want to highlight one extra thing. In the early testing for women who do have risk factors, the recommendation, as I said, is to do testing with your early antenatal bloods with an HbA1c. Some sites, and certainly where one, are encouraging also a fasting glucose at that time. Okay. What we're trying to really do at that point is pick up women with undiagnosed diabetes.
Yeah.
So if women at that stage meet diabetes criteria for outside pregnancy, they should not go through a GTT. They should be given the diagnosis of overt diabetes in pregnancy and management started promptly.
Yep. Great. Thank you so much, Glynis, for joining us and sharing your expertise today. I really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through, I guess, even all the history and how we've gotten to these guideline changes as well, and helping us to understand them in general practice.
Yes, I'm sure it becomes very confusing, particularly when they're saying, why is this changing? And I've got used to the old criteria. Yeah. How does that impact my women, my patients? I think it is important to understand, look, it is hard to put lines in the sand. Most of medicine, there are gray zones. Yeah. And so it's just one of the common areas that everyone is facing, as gestational diabetes is now impacting on close to 20% of pregnancies. We do expect the numbers to go down to about 14-15%. Okay. Still high percentage, though, of women in pregnancy.
Yeah, so it's a really important topic to be aware of. And like you said, it gets complicated, but it's helpful to get some of these background and explanation.
Testing in particular is very much in the hands of the GP.
Yeah.
The whole of pregnancy support should be as well, but the early testing will be GPs. It will not be usually done in the obstetric area.
Great. Thank you so much, Glynis. Again, we really appreciate your time. And again, to everyone tuning in as well, thank you so much for listening. I hope this episode has been useful and has given you some practical insights into managing gestational diabetes and supporting women in your care. Please do keep listening. We've got more episodes coming up with clinical updates in women's health. And I hope you've enjoyed the discussion today. And I look forward to having you with us again soon. So thanks and goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Checkup by Medcast. If you found today's episode helpful, don't forget to follow, rate, and share it with your colleagues. For more episodes, clinical resources, courses, and upcoming events, head to medcast.com.au.